ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 20, The Structure of the Universe. So today we're doing text 31, 32, and 33. Everything's in prose. But I'll read the prose myself anyway. Just Tad vidvipasyap yadipati priyavartro vihithotro naimaitasyat majo. Ramanaka dadki namano varshapati niyujas sa svayam purva javad bhagavat karma shila ivashtate. Word for word. Tatvi pasya of that island. Api also. Adipati the ruler. Priyavrataha a son of Maharaj Priyavrata. Vitihotra nama, named Vitihotra. Itasya of him. Atmajo unto the two sons. Ramanaka. Ramanaka. Dataki and Dataki. Namano, having the names, Varshapati, the rulers of the two tracts of land, Niyujya, appointing, Sasvayam, himself, Purvavajavat, like his other brothers, Bhagavat Karmashila, being absorbed in activities to satisfy the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Eva, indeed. Aste, remains. Translation. The ruler of this island, the son of Maharaj Priyavrata, named Vitihotra, had two sons named Ramanaka and Dataki. He granted the two sides of the island to these two sons and then personally engaged himself in activities for the sake of the Supreme Personality of Godhead like his elder brother, Midatihi. And do we know what island we're discussing? Jambudweep. Jambudweep, no, that we passed that one earlier on. This island, we had a few texts back, is Pushkaradweep. Pushkaradweep. And this island is, how many islands is there in total? Quick recap. The number gets repeated throughout the text many times.
Seven,
yes. There's seven islands, of which the first island is? Jambudweep. And it's interesting, it's like eight chapters that covers this technical area. One, two, three, four, five. But eight or nine chapters that cover this technical area of cosmology. And the first four chapters all discuss Jambudweep. And now we're discussing the other islands very briefly. Because Jambudweep is the one we're on. And it's a key island because it's in the middle. And then we have this chapter, The Structure of the Universe, discussed the next six consecutive islands. And it's the format's been similar throughout the description. You hear the name of the island. How wide is the island always? What's the general description? The island is?
So many
kilometers. Yeah, well, not the technical number. What it's always what? The island is always twice the width of the previous ocean. So the whole thing is very symmetrical. You're given the size of Jambudvip, and the ocean around Jambudvip is twice the size of Jambudvip. Then the next island is twice the size of that ocean, and that ocean is twice the size of that island. So basically it grows bigger by bigger by 50% each, by twice the size. That's 50-100%. Each thing gets twice as big. Each ocean is twice the size of the island, and each next island is twice the size of the ocean. So now we're on the biggest island, Pushkaradvipa. And this island is twice the size of the ocean surrounding it, which was an ocean of yogurt. And then the ocean surrounding this is an ocean of sweet water. I think I got that right. So then when you hear about the island, you hear about the island is separated into how many sections? Seven. Yeah. And in each section, there's a mountain and a river. And how many rivers are there?
Seven.
It's all, some of everything's done in sevens. So there's seven islands, seven oceans. And in each island, there's a mountain range, splits into seven sections. And each section, there's a river. So, and then it's a very brief summary of everything. And each time, then, in this chapter, we hear one prayer by the residents on that island who make a prayer to the worship of deity of those residents. So here we're going to hear the prayer from these residents on Pushkaradvipa. So text 32. For the fulfillment of material desires, the inhabitants of this tract of land worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead as represented by Lord Brahma. They offered prayers to the Lord as follows. So this is the prayer made by the residents on Pushkaradvipa to Lord Brahma. Lord Brahma is known as Karma Maya, the form of ritualistic ceremonies. Because by performing ritualistic ceremonies, one may attain his position, and because the Vedic ritualistic hymns become manifest from him. He is devoted to the Supreme Personality of Godhead without deviation, and therefore, in one sense, he is not different from the Lord. Nevertheless, he should be worshipped not as the monists worship him, but in duality. One should always remain a servitor of the Supreme Lord, the Supreme Worshipable Deity. We, therefore, offer our respectful obeisances unto Lord Brahma, the form of manifest Vedic knowledge. Purport. In this verse, the word Karma Mayam, obtainable by the Vedic ritualistic system, is significant. The Vedas say, Svadharma Nishtasata Janmabi Puman Virinchatam Eti. One who strictly follows the principles of Varnashram Dharma for at least 100 births will be rewarded with the post of Lord Brahma. It is also significant that although Lord Brahma is extremely powerful, he never thinks himself one with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He always knows that he is an eternal servitor of the Lord. Because the Lord and the servant are identical on the spiritual platform, Brahma is herein addressed as Bhagavan. Bhagavan is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, but if a devotee serves him with full faith, the meaning of the Vedic literature is revealed to him. Therefore, Brahma is called Brahmalinga, which indicates that his entire form consists of Vedic knowledge. Omigena Timurandasya Gena Janashvaka. So, this section is always interesting for us as devotees. Everybody's favorite section of the Bhagavatam, the cosmological section. But it's really I was listening from some presentations by Chaitanya Charan Prabhu, who has a website called The Spiritual Scientist. I would recommend it very much. He has a question and answer format to the website. And lots of time he's got one section on Vedic cosmology, and devotees ask questions about this section. And he basically says, it's actually a very, very, very small section. The Bhagavatam is how many verses in the Bhagavatam in total? 18,000 verses. And basically this cosmological section comes to about 300 texts. So it's not much. We'll soon be back into more regular Bhagavatam topics of philosophy. As you know, we're all very wary to speak on cosmological issues. And rightly so, actually. Rightly, we should be apprehensive to discuss it, because it is, it's extremely, extremely difficult to understand. The universe is a complicated place. It's not easy to grasp. And specifically, the universe, as is described in the Puranas, which is, of course, the Srimad Bhagavatam is a Purana. The Vedas, the universe can be understood from two perspectives. You have the Puranic description and the Jyoti prescription, Jyoti Shastra. And basically, the Puranic is from those who are higher beings with higher conscience looking down, and the Jyoti is our perspective looking up. And they're the same, but from different perspectives, the descriptions come out quite different. They come out quite different, the descriptions. So, to understand the perspective from the Puranic perspective of how those are looking down upon the universe, you can't do it mechanically. It's not possible. You can't have the consciousness to perceive it unless it's revealed to you. Even though this seems like technical details about sizes and dimensions, and this is double this size, this, and there's a mountain range here, it sounds like geography. And it is geography, but it's geography from the higher perspective. And we can't understand it unless it's revealed to us. Because it's you need consciousness. You need the right consciousness to see it. It's like we're here on Jambudvip. And what's in the middle of Jambudvip? What's right in the middle of our place? What is that?
Radhadesh.
Okay, Radhadesh is definitely the middle of Rupa Manjari Mataji's island, that is for sure. Yeah. Nothing but Radhadesh. Mount Meru is right in the middle. And basically it's out there, Mount Meru. And it's a rather large mountain. I'm not very good at figures, so I'm not going to try and repeat the size. Yeah. And we wonder, well, where is the mountain? Why can't we see it? It's there. But because things are not just two and three dimensional, things are four, five, six, seven, many dimensional. And to see it, you have to have the consciousness to see those extra dimensions. And that's therefore why this is a bewildering section. And even so much so that Lord Brahma himself, even though he's the creator, there's many times there's texts describing Lord Brahma not understanding his own creation. And he is the ultimate egghead. I don't know if that expression in English, egghead, is like a very intellectual, cerebral person. Well, Brahma is personified intelligence. He's the creator. He puts it all together. He puts everything in position, and he turns around and goes, I don't understand this. How does it work? And the reason is, ultimately, Brahma doesn't really create it. We know he's the secondary creator. The original creator is Krishna. And basically, Brahma is given, I like the word, a template. He's given the plans. And one little detail mentioned is quite amusing. We know when the universe was created, right? Brahma was born. Where is he? He's sitting on lotus flower. What's the first thing he tries to do? He tries to climb down. So here by his own endeavor, he climbs down the lotus stem, trying to find, okay, where did I come from? And we know he's not successful. And eventually he goes back up. But when he's going down, he climbs through the stem. And it's described in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita that while climbing through the stem, he gets the blueprints of the universe. So he gets the detailed structure how to do it. So Krishna gives to Brahma what he has to do, and Brahma just does the job, really. He's not anyway the actual designer or the actual creator. His job is just to put it in motion. So when Brahma does that, he turns around and goes, whew, it's impressive. So it's nice to hear, actually, many times Brahma makes very, very humble prayers. And there's one nice point made, therefore, that usually anybody, like Brahma, talk about responsibility. No one has more responsibility than Lord Brahma. Both materially and spiritually, right? He's the creator of the universe, and he's the head of our Sampradaya. So he maintains an extremely exalted material post, an extremely exalted spiritual post. And it's said, actually, that take its toll on even Lord Brahma. It's such a complex, the universe is so vast, so complex, that it really you could say, the ultimate manager is Lord Brahman, and he there's verses you'll come across where he expresses the hard work he has in managing the whole universal affairs. So, So this perspective, it's from the pranic perspective, is from the higher realms, which needs higher consciousness to see it. So therefore, why is it here? Why is this details given? Well, throughout the Bhagavatam, there's kind of repeated sections that are quite technical. I mean, you think of the second canto, the third canto, and this canto, really where it's very technical. In the second canto, what's the most technical section? What does it discuss? In the second canto, there's about 3 or 4 chapters given over to describing something. What's described? Anybody? Okay, here's a clue. It's an imaginary concept. It's described how it's not actually factual. It's an imaginary concept. No? The Virat Rupa, the universal form of the Lord. So throughout the second canto, there's many descriptions about the universes are this is the universe is made up of this different parts, and these parts are all of the Virat Rupa, the universal form of the Lord, a different universal form than Arjuna sees. So this is and there's quite detailed descriptions given about how the nail, like the mountains in the universe are his bones, and air is the life air in his body, and things like this. But it's said in the text, and Srila Prabhupada repeats, it's kind of an imaginary concept given to us to understand the universe, to get some basic idea how the universe is structured. So this is a conceptual perspective of how to appreciate the universe. Then in the third canto, we have a detailed breakdown. Shishirada Gopi Nadi Tavishaka Ki Jai Konitai Ki Jai Jagannath Baladev Subhadra Ki Jai. In the third canto, then we're given the atomic structure of the universe, a very detailed atomic breakdown of how things are structured. So we're given what you could say an analytical view of the universe. So the second canto gives us a conceptual view of the universe. The third canto gives us a technical and not an atomic, you could say, or like the modern scientists, like they do nowadays, they try to break everything down, and that's Sankhya. And now we're given a model version, how it's all shaped. You're presented with the model. This is how it looks all together. This is actually how it's structured. And that's why we're hearing basically geography, and even the geography is broken down into like different things, like the actual practical details, and then there's the origin, the cosmological, how it all came about. And then later on we'll hear astrological things about the effects different things have. So so you can say this has... Why does Sukadev Goswami spend so much time describing the universe from these different concepts, from the theoretical perspective, an analytical, and now a model perspective? Well, one is, it's from everything really, we need to identify and we need to see things. Tribhuvanpuri used a lovely expression, from the gross. Now, from the subtle comes the gross. So we only perceive gross. So for many people, they need to start with something gross, really. And then you go inwards. Like, for many devotees, what's the first thing that attracts them to the encounter in Krishna consciousness? Prasadam. It's something gross in the external sense. Of course, we know it's not spiritual. So people are attracted, but the first thing has to be some contact with the gross world around them, because the senses are so covered. The senses cannot conceive of these things. So Sukadeva Goswami puts time into describing these things so people can start to identify, because that's how they identify with their senses. So, okay, here's a way to see the universe around you. But they're very brief sections. And in reality, they all boil down what actually happens, even in this section of, say, 300 verses in this cosmological section, mostly, and what we have here today, is a prayer. It's really a lot of prayers, really. We heard the prayers of the personalities involved offering to the Lord. So it's really, the actual details are only very, very briefly mentioned. And we shouldn't get too bothered about it either, in one sense. Sometimes devotees we hear and get like, it doesn't make sense, I'm confused by it. Well, and if one is confused by it, then move on, no big deal. The point is one shouldn't get stuck on these things. One reason, because we can't understand it. The Puranic cosmology is a process of revelation. The conscience has to be clear, purified enough to be able to perceive these things. And it's also like throughout our Gaudiya Vaishnava literature, nobody has really given commentaries on this section either. There's many, many commentaries on the Bhagavatam, and of course it's included, but specifically more commentaries on the 10th canto, because that's what Gaudiya Vaishnavas are more directly concerned about, Krishna's pastimes. But ISKCON has a different challenge. Interesting enough, Srila Prabhupada is practically unique now in all of the acharyas in the Gaudiya line to emphasize cosmology. So that's why the devotees engaged in the Vedic Planetarium have been for many, many years, and to this point, our greatest scholars, our brilliant, most brilliant minds, as they say in the material world, our very advanced devotees, are seriously scratching their head how to do it. Because it's a tough task. It has not been done previously by anybody in the Gaudiya Vaishnava history, because it wasn't so required, actually. But nowadays, we know it is required, because who rules the world nowadays, for the most part? It's the scientists. Scientists called the shots. And people have, we know, an extremely absurd blind faith in science. And somebody gave an example. If somebody's told not to sit in that chair, it's got wet paint on it. Most people go, are you sure? Oh yeah, okay. Yeah, it's wet paint. Everybody, if it's possible, everybody likes to verify something. Oh, that's a little sour. Is it? Okay, let me... Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's sour. Okay. Everybody, when it's possible, they like to verify things with their senses, if it's possible. And everybody does. But when the scientific world turns around and tells them it's 20 pulsar quasars between here and the nebula solar system, everybody goes, oh, really? Wow, that's really interesting. Or there is like 4.6 billion... stars in our Milky Way, or the sun is XXX amount of billion light years away from us. Oh, really? That's far out. Did you hear? That's the sun's so far away. Everybody just repeats it completely blindly. I mean, completely blindly. The world is in a very blind state of scientists. But we understand that's changing. That is changing also. There is an increasing wave of frustration and... Dinesh, who yesterday was mentioning the... it was an interesting comparison he made between the Occupy people and the hippies. It's like the new hippie movement of the time. It's spread all over the world, and right now it's all happening in Istanbul. There's a huge Occupy thing going on there, and the government's clamping down, and people are just... But it's very like the hippie movement. They don't know what they're doing. They just want to revolt against the system. And he was saying how they're desperately in need of a leader. So, an interesting comparison. because they're getting frustrated. People are frustrated with what the scientific world, most people know that it's what they tell us is very theoretical. And the state of the world, led by the scientific purview, is causing chaos for the natural world and for the economic world. Oh yeah. So they're getting frustrated, and therefore Srila Prabhupada's emphasis on creating a temple. And I was thinking, it's been for like 30 years it's going to try to be create this temple. I'm not sure people have seen or older plans. There was the first concept years ago by Sarabi Prabhu, and then there was another concept, and then there was Harikesh Prabhu's super far out complex that was trying to create, and now we have it going on. But even when the building is finished, as far as I understand, I'm not sure if this is completely correct, even when the planetarium is finished, they're still not quite sure how to do the cosmological structure inside. We've seen pictures of this nice chandelier with beams, but that's a digital production. The reality of creating that and the actual structure and how to lay it out, Arvinda Suprabhu says, we are just starting. We are really just starting to touch on how to get at it. And reality is because we cannot understand, again, by our own endeavors. We have to try to understand it. And when Krishna is pleased, he will reveal the cosmology. He will reveal how it's understood. And then it'll be perfectly. And I could even speculate that maybe when the time is right, Krishna will reveal it, and then the Vedic planetarium will manifest at the right time. At the right time. And timing, Krishna is very Krishna has a keen interest in timing. Like Srila Prabhupada's coming in 1965, the timing features were quite incredible. Satya Rajguru wrote a wonderful, wonderful essay on how so many factors of time were perfect for that year for Prabhupada to come. If he'd come a year before, it wouldn't have worked. A couple of years after, probably wouldn't have worked either. From the external perspective, there was like four or five different timings were perfect. So the planetarium has been one of ISKCON's challenges many years, and now it's happening. But then when it all going well for 2016, all going to plan, which of course everybody knows it might be challenged, but then inside of it they've a lot more work to do then too. And Srila Prabhupada's very unique emphasis on this is because the world needs to see a different perspective. And as Dhanishpuri yesterday ISKCON, we have to present to them another perspective, and cosmology is the first way we can do that. The universe is not what they say. It's not this mechanical, lifeless, empty place. And I always fascinated by how they picture it so lifeless and mechanical. But in the world around us, in this world, when they want to depict something like a car wash, is one of my favorite examples. At a car wash, usually at the front of the car wash, what sort of image do they have? At the front of a car wash, what do they have? Picture of a car. And usually how is the car depicted? A big smile on its face, a couple of eyes, some suds around it. This funny, friendly little image of a car being happy to be washed. Everybody, we love giving personality to things. And it's inherent in us. And like, you see, watch anything, any advertisement, kids' things, of course, everything becomes alive, everything's animate. Because inherently, we want personalism, we want characters, we want to deal with things in a personal way. And we understand from the Vedic cosmology, everything is alive. Everything's alive and personal, from the wind, the water, the fire, the structure. There's nothing that's, or even though for a certain sense we say this is inanimate, dead, there's no consciousness in it. But I like a scripture recently. This is, it may seem unconscious, but a devotee doesn't treat it like that. Because Krishna's conscious of it. Krishna's very conscious of everything. Because it's all Krishna's energy. So a devotee sees it like that. So in one sense, I like this point why a devotee never does anything with his foot. Because a Vaishnav, the foot is always considered a dirty thing. So to do something with your foot, unless you have to walk on the ground, etc., etc. Apart from obvious practical things, a devotee never does something with his foot because it's Krishna. He's conscious of what this is, and it's part of him. So this is how a devotee really grows a very respectful attitude towards the world around us. We don't disrespect anything. So this cosmology, it's a small section, and it's... And when we're ready, Krishna will reveal it to us, and Prabhupada has given ISKCON this challenge to try and understand it as much as possible. And then just briefly, This prayer was made to Lord Brahma. And Lord Brahma is a very he's a very special personality. I was thinking, like, it'd be nice to do a whole study on Lord Brahma, because, like, throughout the whole Bhagavatam, he's mentioned, like, hundreds upon hundreds and hundreds of times. In every canto, there's so many references to Lord Brahma. And it's nice specifically here in this purport, Prabhupada says, because the Lord and the servant are identical on the spiritual platform, Brahma is here and addressed as Bhagavan. No, here. It is also significant that although Lord Brahma is extremely powerful, he never thinks himself one with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He always knows that he's an eternal servitor of the Lord. So I'd like to just pick up on this point, that Lord Brahma is the most powerful personality in the universe. He's given huge responsibility, and yet he's very deeply absorbed in his position as a servant of the Lord. And this is not an easy task, because he is so empowered, so given so much responsibility. It's very easily for one who is given great responsibility to think, well, I am doing this, I am achieving this. And the nature, especially in Brahma's service, there's one prayer Brahma makes that I personally always like. It's in the third canto, the prayers, Brahma's prayers for creative, in the creative energy. Prayers, by forget the exact title, but third canto, when Brahma's creating the universe and he's given the job, he says, the Supreme Lord, the Personality of Godhead, is always the benefactor of the surrendered souls. His activities are always enacted through his internal potency, Rama, or the Goddess of Fortune. I pray only to engage in his service in the creation of the material world, and I pray that I not be materially affected by my works, for thus I may be able to give up the false prestige of being the creator. So this is, I think, such a nice prayer, Brahma, especially in creative things. I know myself being agitated by the passionate energy to create things all the time. It's a powerful energy, and therefore very quickly you can become absorbed in, I am the creator. It's me that's creating this. It's coming from me. So therefore we have to constantly pray not to be affected by this. And there's a very, very sweet description of this in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, where we hear Narada Muni is going through various personalities to find who is the recipient, best recipient of Krishna's mercy. So previously he'd just been with Indra. Of course Indra then says, no, it's not me. It's my authority, it's Brahma. So the way it's structured is that therefore Indra then gives reasons why Brahma is the greatest receiver of mercy. And then Narada Muni takes those points and then goes to the person and makes the prayers. So Narada Muni then goes from Indra to Brahma and says all these prayers that he just heard from Indra to praise Lord Brahma. And then when the person hears these prayers, they're always like completely disgusted. What are you saying? Especially in Brahma's case, it's because it's very amusing. When Brahma first hears Narada's prayers, what does Brahma do? Close his ears. How many ears? All 8 ears. Brahma's got all 8 ears to cover with his hands. But we don't hear that he's got 8 hands. He's got 4 heads. Huh?
Many fingers.
Many fingers, yeah, maybe. So maybe he's stretching anyways. We don't know exactly what dimension he works within. But Brahma covers all his ears, all 8 ears, with his hands to stop hearing Narada's glorification. And specifically, one very interesting point is that Indra says, because Brahma, he is the original creator. So that when Narada takes his point and goes repeats it to Brahma, because you are the original creator, Brahma turns around and said, what have I told you? Did I not tell you in the third canto of Srimad Bhagavatam that Krishna is the original creator? He chastises in a very sweet, personal way. Have you not listened to what I've said? And it's interesting. So even Narada Muni is told something, and then he kind of forgets it and goes on with making his enthusiastic prayers. Because we hear that Narada Muni approaches Brahma in the third canto and tries to understand, well, you're praying to somebody, who are you praying to? And Brahma explains, well, I'm not the creator, Krishna is the creator, and I'm just his servant. So here we have the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, it's happening again, and Brahma very nicely chastises Narada and says, don't say such things, I'm just the servant of the Lord. The Lord reveals it all to me, I just carry it out. I found the plans in the stem. I sat on the lotus flower and followed the instructions I was given from Tapasya, and by the revelation of my engagement of austerities in bhakti yoga. He makes that point a lot. He performed a great austerity, tapa, but in bhakti yoga. So it was devotional service that he performed, not any sort of external austerities. And therefore Krishna manifested himself to Brahma. So Brahma's very, very humble attitude. And Brahma, in his defense of why he deserves to be humble, he gives examples of his mistakes that he's made. And because what's Brahma's oldest mistake, you could say? The first mistake Brahma made? What's the one that's the oldest mistake he made that he got chastised for? So that'll be the most recent one. That's only 5,000 years ago. In terms of universal, what was Brahma? What's the oldest pastime that we know that Brahma? That could be possible too. But okay, come back a little. what Leela we just celebrated recently? What festival do we celebrate recently that Brahma was culpable? He was part of the responsibility of creating a great disaster. Hiranyakasipu. Yeah, it was Hiranyakasipu. Where did he get all his power from? Brahma. And then what did Hiranyakasipu do? Torture the universe, terrorize the universe, and specifically torture one of Krishna's great devotees. That's a major mistake. To give somebody a power to torture a devotee is a serious mistake. So Brahma says, look, I did this. And then we hear when Lord Nrsingadev appears and kills Hiranyakasipu, all the demigods are there, including Brahma and Lord Shiva. Krishna, Lord Nrsingadev is not, we know he doesn't take their prayers, they're praying, and he still remains in his angry mood until Prahlad comes and makes his prayer. And it's pointed out that even after when Prahlad makes his prayer, we hear Lord Nrsingadev calms down, then Lord Brahma comes up again and goes, I'm sorry, that's my fault. Lord Nrsingadev gets a little bit angry again, actually. He just has still a bit of anger in his system, and he says, don't do such things, don't give benedictions to people who aren't qualified for them, don't do it. And Brahma gets his chastisement. But then what does Brahma do a few millennia later? What how does he repeat the same mistake? Who does he also give great power to that terrorizes the universe?
Don't think so. He was just a thing.
Ravana? Also a devotee of Lord Brahma. Ravana again. And Brahma points out, after Lord Nrsingadev specifically told me not to do it, I do it again. I go off and I give power to somebody who in this case steals Krishna's wife. Again, it gets more absurd, the things that they're doing. And Brahma actually makes a point in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita that he takes personal responsibility for it. And even when the demigods, when he's given reasons why he's not the recipient of Krishna's mercy, he points out all these mistakes. And then he said, look at this. Well, then look at Indra. He's done so many terrible things. That's my fault. Indra and Govardhan. And he says, Varuna. What was Varuna's big mistake? What etiquette that he step over? Varuna. Yeah, Varuna, the god of the sea. What does he do that gets a bit outrageous? Oh, that's another one. Yeah. Oh, that's Yamaraj. Yeah, that's what Yamaraj does, which is quite outrageous. He takes the son of Sandipani Muni. But Varuna kidnaps Krishna's father. Just because of what? A few seconds in the wrong titi. is likely kidnaps him and takes him under the water. So Brahma mentions that, Varuna gets carried away, and then Yamaraj steals the son of your guru. I mean, these are all outrageous behaviors done by people that I'm in charge of. That's what Brahma does. He gives Indra his position, he gives Varuna, Yamaraj. He allocates everybody their service. And therefore, when they mess up, he gets the blame. And he takes the reaction. It's the way it works. The person on top takes all the reaction, takes all the responsibility personally, and then takes any a portion of the reaction. It's just the way the universe is structured, from Brahma down. So Brahma's saying all these things. So he gave power to Ranikasipu, he gave power to Ravana. And then, of course, we know his own personal, direct misdemeanor. When he sees Krishna, he thinks, hey, this doesn't make sense. And it's with understanding that Brahma gets a little bewildered there, because on Brahma's planet, Krishna is there. And what form is Krishna there? He says, in the Mahapurusha. And the Mahapurusha is the thousand-headed form of Vishnu. So, thousand-headed form must be quite impressive, right? It's like, and he's constantly being fed. It's like a river of yogis into the Mahapurusha. He's constantly being fed. And then after the sacrifice is finished, the Mahapurusha takes rest. And then Brahma suddenly sees this little boy would like, he's like, he's young, and not a little boy, he's doing all sorts of strange things. I think in a class I gave some time ago, we tried to discuss the thing about the rice in the hand. Krishna stand there with some yogurt and rice mixed together. And there's different little significance of that. One I read after I gave the class is that he was standing there with prasadam in his left hand. And we don't do that, right? We don't do that. And Brahma is a personification of ritualistic activities. that's why this is one of the meaning of karma maya. He embodies ritualistic activities. So Krishna standing here with prasadam in his left hand thinking, when you're finished, I want to eat this. And I don't care which hand it's in, I'm going to eat it. So Krishna was, and also we hear internally Krishna was thinking, why is he, who is this? And I think it's Brahma. Why is he making all these prayers to me? What's this about? Krishna didn't come out of his lila mood of being a small cowherd boy in Vrindavan. So, but it's a little understandable Brahma got confused. Here's the Mahapurusha, 10,000-headed form of Krishna, and then this little boy, something's wrong. So he got a little bewildered, but we know he quickly made up. So Brahma says, look at all these mistakes I made. So it's very, very sweet, very humble, actually. And that's what basically we can take from Brahma. Even though we become very, very powerful, we will make great mistakes. We can, especially the more power we're given, the more likelihood we will make with the big power, big mistakes. And we've seen that in our own lives and our own history. But Brahma maintains his service very nicely, because he's always very apologetic. He's very humble about it. He always takes a very nice response. Okay, so you say, Brahma, you could talk at length for him, but this is why the residents of Pushkara Dvipa are offering prayers to Lord Brahma. Has anybody any questions on simple cosmology or Lord Brahma? Yadarani Manaji. Holding it in. The boys won't start eating until Krishna eats first, so he's waiting for Brahma to go and to quickly honor his yogurt rice, so the cowherd boys then can start their lunch. Yeah, so there's lots of little everything Krishna does has got so many significant reasons. So thank you. Yeah, it's also a little confusing. Like, how come they're obviously the demigods, they're empowered living entities, they're very advanced devotees, they're obviously highly intelligent, and yet, from our perspective, we think they make really silly mistakes. We think, so thinking, wow, I wouldn't do that. I'd know it's better not to do that. But we have to be careful to presuppose how we would be dealing with such an empowered position. There's an expression in English, power goes to your head. And we know devotees who are given a position of importance and power in our society, we can see it. It goes to their head. They can't, unless they maintain a nice attitude. So demigods, as far as I understand, mostly it's the system is a mechanical system, and they're obliged to reciprocate. And Krishna says that in the Bhagavad Gita by offering oblations to the demigods, they reciprocate, and that's just because it's their job, it's their law, it's what they have to do. And that's why Krishna says, if you want anything, come to me, because I'll use a little more discretion. I do in such a way that considers the person. But demigods, yes, it's quite amazing that they don't. They just give out powers because they've been petitioned to do so. They've been requested to do so. And it's their job. So they kind of like are very bureaucratic in that sense, it seems like. But it'd be nice to look at it more deeply to see, because it's also a little bewildering how such advanced personalities don't see the consequences of what they do, or what they might do. So why don't they see the consequences? It's again, I can only conclude that the position, it's their duty and they have to perform it. And in positions of such power, you cannot see the possible consequences. So Brahma does it, Lord Shiva does it. So many personalities give out boons that have bad consequences. Yeah, I guess that's all I can say for now. Probably, I vaguely recall a better understanding of why they're obliged to do it, even if they know it's not the right thing to do. It's just the laws that they have to, they're duty-bound to do it. They're duty-bound, and duty is the highest thing. Even if they know it's the wrong thing, it's their duty to do it. But Krishna's not duty-bound like that. He can decide. Krishna also gives it. We know Krishna, if you ask and ask and you pray, Krishna always gives, but gives in such a way that it doesn't cause, it gets ultimate benefit, right? I think Lord Shiva prays like that. Doesn't Shiva? Lord Shiva prays, at some point he gives benediction to somebody, and there's one prayer he makes, I know I shouldn't have done it, but what could I do? I had to give it, because I was duty-bound. My service is to do it. So it's, I guess you could say maybe it's the power of duty that they have to carry it out, even if they know it's going to do harm. That's the best I would have for now, I think. Mahaprabhu?
That seems that it wasn't a mistake by Lord Brahma to give the benediction to Sabriana Kashyapu if he's duty bound. If he's not duty bound, how such a powerful entity makes mistakes, how can he rectify himself? And if not,
Yeah, most. That's most our conclusion. We have to be careful to second guess, or like we hear that we should not to know. It's impossible to know the mind of a Vaishnava. Brahma is a very exalted Vaishnava, and the position he holds, we can't really understand it. It may be a case, I would. What's the point? Oh yeah, in relation to motivation, I was thinking how we hear the motivation is a very important thing, but not as far as Krishna's concerned. Not really. Krishna's like takes the essence. We hear Bhavagya Janardana. Motivation is important as far as we're concerned. We have to be always watching our motivation to see why am I doing it so it makes a better offering. So I could therefore transfer that to the position of the demigods, is that it's their duty to do it. They're obliged to do it. They have to do it. But when they do it, and then it has a bad consequences, they take it as their responsibility. It's my mistake. I take responsibility for it. And then they come and make prayers. Because that's the humble attitude of a Vaishnava. So in one sense, they have no choice. But because there's still consequence of it, they take responsibility for it. And that's a nice, humble Vaishnava attitude to do. And that's always my bottom line definition of a devotee. He simply takes full responsibility for everything. Well, that's another point. But that's our final point. But it's also a point we shouldn't come to so quickly. There is many lessons to be learned along the way that Krishna also wants us to pick up on, apart from the final point that it's Krishna's pastimes. But Krishna really wants us, a devotee, to always take responsibility for everything, whatever happens. And not, especially when something has gone wrong, a devotee takes responsibility. Even so much so that actually a devotee takes such responsibility, a Brahman or Shiva, or Krishna's topmost devotees, even if somebody acts badly towards us, a devotee takes responsibility for it. I read that recently. Just so much is the mood of a devotee to take responsibility for my actions, for my consequences, for what happens to me, but even for other people's behavior, a devotee takes responsibility. And there's a whole discussion on why that's the case, how we bring out in others what we have in ourselves. And if somebody approaches us in a difficult way, if we react a nice way, we bring out the good in them. So we have to, a devotee takes responsibility about others deal with us. So much so is the mood of the devotee take responsibility. So that's why I would conclude. Brahma turned around and said, "It was my duty to do it, to give the power to Rani Kasipu and Ravana, but it was my mistake also." That's the humble attitude of a Vaishnava. Okay. Grantarajima Bhagavatam ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.